My dad bought a factory exactly like this.
And 25 wire wheels.
Hey?
Wire wheels?
Not wire or steel.
Or steel, yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't have the rubber.
Oh, no. Exactly like this. Exactly like this. This is a 1924 model.
Yeah.
My dad bought this.
McCormick.
1020 McCormick Deering. Exactly like that, 1925, and he bought a thrashing machine.
That must have been the first machinery you...
Maybe not the... You mean the first in the region?
No,
it was the first good thrashing machine. Before that, there was not temporary, how do you say it, stationary.
Mm-hmm.
They had stationary engines,
mm-hmm,
that with a thrashing machine, you know, but a tractor like that. And I remember when I was about 4 years old, a steam engine come to my place to thrash.
Really?
Yeah. My dad didn't like that at all, because they burnt all the fire posts and half of his... we didn't have no bushy.
Right.
Well, our farm was all cleared. And they cleaned up everything that was in the yard.
I can imagine. So I guess he wouldn't get too
clear. That was the only time they had a steam engine.
Was your father the first one to farm... on the farm or with
yes,
his father?
Yes, it was. The farm was bought in by my grandfather in about 1870. But we celebrated together the 100th anniversary in 1972 because the contract was dated 1876. And I was at the registrar.
Mm-hmm.
Russell and told him about this. I says, by the age that my dad says that they built the house, they must have been there in 1870. We says, that could be. He says, at that time, they sold, if they sold a part of land, that's directly from the Crown. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't give them
the deed
right away.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes people bought the farm and they just cut some bush off of it and then
right.
They'd disappear and they wouldn't stay there. And they said they'd send an inspector 4 or 5 years later, see if the people were still living there or
right.
If they were going to make a living out of the farm. And if they were going to make a living out of the farm, they gave them the deed.
Okay, was it a grant, a farm, or
No, it's a deed, $100 for 100 acres.
For 100 acres?
Yep.
It's a good price.
Good price.
Mind you, it was probably expensive then.
It was possibly. My grandfather was a shoemaker and he had a few sons, so I suppose he wanted to establish it.
Okay.
He
is
was
this
living in
the Harvard. Home farm or is this the home farm?
No. Yeah, the home farm's over there.
Okay. Yeah.
The brick house.
Right.
Over there.
Okay. Yeah. That's the home farm. And this one was purchased after?
Oh yeah, I purchased this.
For some reason, I always thought that house was older over here.
Oh, yeah, it's possibly. Oh, yeah, it is. It was, too. I purchased this farm. Oh, Jesus. No. A lot later.
Who owned the farm before you? Or?
It was a fellow by the name of Farmer. But Bertrand, Seraphim Bertrand, owned the farm. And then he took sick, and he was old, and he had sold it. And it passed several hands and was rented from
mm-hmm.
one to the other, you know, for years. Finally, this fellow lived in Gatineau that had bought the farm. And he wanted to get rid of it, and he came to see me one day, and I bought the farm. And this was 76 acres. Let me see. I should know all these things, you know.
Oh, well, sometimes...
My heart. But if you want to get into the 40s,
yeah.
You're less to do.
In the 30s, you were young. Was there a school here that you went to? And
yeah. They called it the number 14 separate school. Ontario separate school number 14.
Was it taught in French or English at that time?
When I started school in 1925, French was still illegal in this province. French was still illegal. It was in 1927 that it was redrawn. I think it was possibly in the early 20s or late 19, a little before that, that they had passed a rule mm-hmm. in the province of Ontario that French was illegal there. And at that time, they always taught French here just the same. And in most of the French schools, they always continued to speak French, but maybe they were doing it with Wesley to go. And I remember, we had the motto or the order, if the inspector came along, and the inspector was naturally English speaking, we all took our bags and went home. So the inspector was left there with only the teacher. But that never happened when I went to school. Uh-huh. I remember of an English-speaking inspector coming to the school once, and he was only there. I think they were just about on the way of retrieving that.
Well, it surprised me. I looked at some documents recently, some tax bills from 1919. These are the original documents, and they were sent in French, totally in French.
In Cumberland.
And this is Dave Carew's tax bills from 1919, totally in French. And I said to him, this is strange. I thought everything would come out. Now, in 1923, the one he got was in English, but previous to that was French, and after that it was French. He just assumed that because he was French, he got them in French. But it seemed strange. I thought it was odd.
I have some old tax bills.
Look them up. They're signed by...
Well, I'm telling you, I'm so bilingual that sometimes I read an article someplace, you know. I get French magazines and I got English magazines, you know, and agricultural magazines. Sometimes I never noticed.
Yeah, and I never remembered when he said the French school in Vars started, but I think it started in the 40s maybe?
Oh yeah, it started a lot later.
Go ahead.
No, the French school in Vars started a lot later.
Yeah.
This was the only French community here.
Was the school near where it is now, or
yeah, as far as I, as far as.
So you didn't have a long walk.
No. As far as I can remember, yeah. Oh, yeah. It must have been before that because it was a brick school when I started. Had been built in 1910. I remember the plaque. They should have kept that plaque. There was a big plaque there. I don't know if it was stone or steel. There was a big plaque in front of mm-hmm. in front of the school there that said Ontario Separate School number 14.
Now, how long did you go to school?
I went here 10 years.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Do you find that longer than most?
Well, I tell you, they had permission about in the 1930s there. They had permission to teach 9th and 10th year in the separate schools.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the schools that were big enough, that had enough of pupils, and here we happened to have 10 that had passed their entrance
mm-hmm.
here. And they, I guess it was the trustees that applied to have a grant for this. And they built another addition to the school, and I made my 9th and 10th year here, and then there was funny things at that time, you know. They gave grants at your 10th year. There was an exam that they called it the model entrance. And if you passed all your subjects with a certain mark, they paid your, because there was very few high schools where they taught French,
mm-hmm.
one in Sturgeon Falls and I think one in Rockland, maybe one in Van Cleek Hill too, I think. and maybe I think there was about three in the province. And for bilingual students, they paid 70 cents a day for your board. And on all the gang that we were here that tried the model entrance, you know, and this was every subject, you know.
Trigonometry.
No. There was no trigonometry in that here. But there was arithmetic. There was a little bit of, there was geography, there was history, there was spelling, composition, was another word for that.
Literature.
You know, I think we went to Rockland, I think, 4 or 5 days, and we had an examination in the morning, in the afternoon. I think about 10 subjects, you know. And I was the only one that passed. And the next year, I went to school in Rockland. And during the summer, I had had a pneumonia. I was sick. And I am sure now, you know, that the year I went to Rockland, what's this sickness that a lot of the kids have today there that
yeah. Not sure. they get a lot of things to get.
I don't remember how you call it.
No.
I'm going to ask my wife a little later.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm sure that I had that. You know, I had that pneumonia in the summer. You know. Went to school.
Maybe it weakened you.
Yeah, it weakened me, and it affected my whole system. Anyway, I went to Rockland, and I was good in some subjects, but in some subjects I was too late. Like in geometry, I remember there was an old school lady there, Mrs. Ryan. I knew she must have been a very good teacher in the geometry. But we were only about three that came from the exterior.
Mm-hmm.
There was one that came from the north. There was a...
You
maybe
boarded
one
right at the school or with family?
At the school in no, I was boarding in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And we were about three or four in the class, you know, of about 30 that came from the exterior. So she knew where her pupils had been in the 10th year. So the geometry, you know, there's 1, 2, 3 books. We had seen a little bit of the first book. They had seen through the 12th theorem in the second book. And she went through those, the first book in about a week, you know. I was completely lost. By Christmas time, I had quit geometry. And I remember her and the principal keeping me after an art, and they say, "What's wrong with you, Desi? You should be one of our best pupils. You passed all your exams last June. And you don't seem to be getting anywhere. Are you sick?" I didn't think I was sick at 15 years old. No. I didn't think I was sick. But I knew I was sick that year. Anyway, I didn't pass no. Next year, I was out for my board because I didn't pass my examination. I went to school at the continuation school at Navin. I took all the subjects available. I mean, I even took some in we called it at that time, middle school and lower
mm-hmm.
school, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I even took some subjects in lower school that I hadn't taken before, like botany or something, and zoology and things like this. And everything went just right. I remember 92 in physics and 90 in geometry. And we had a teacher by the name of Powell there. He started at the beginning of the book, and bing, 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 you know. Jesus, I picked it up just like that, and hell, I was...
Do you think, if... Like, how far did you go into school?
The next year. I never finished my 12th year. My 12th year, yeah. Then we're coming into the... We're in the 30s there now.
Mm-hmm.
And the 12th year... That was something like 1937. I had an older brother that was helping my dad on the farm. Things were tough, eh? I remember my dad hiring a man $10 a month, you know, the very best of a man. And sometimes at the end of the month he didn't have no money to pay him.
Mm-hmm.
And the second year of my school at Navan, things weren't going that good. The principal was gone. We got another principal by the name of a Mr. Fisher, who didn't think that, I think he had a little bit of a grudge against the French, too. He'd made me read French, you know, that I could read in my fourth year, you know. They called it French for English, or they called it ordinary French at that time. And the French, for the French, was special French. That you could only get that at the other high schools. And what they called was ordinary French, and I remember one time reading a paragraph or something like that. And he made me reread a sentence, you know. He said I had made a mistake in that sentence. He asked the other pupils, but nobody lifted their hands. He asked me if I had made he told me that I had made an error in that sentence. So I reread the sentence. I thought it was a liaison, you know, or something, and I reread it very carefully. And he made me pronounce the word cœur.
Heart.
Yeah. And he wanted me to pronounce it this way, cœur. Well, I said, all right, the core. So after that, it made me mad, you know. So I went, after four, speaking, I said, I don't think you have to make a face like that. Anyway, you see, in a small school like Navan, you could only take, like, one mathematics a year, eh? One year they'd teach algebra, and the other year they'd teach geometry. One year they'd teach ancient history, and one year they'd teach Canadian history. And, you know, they had to, it was two teachers, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So, I was only taking three subjects, and it wasn't getting me anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have enough to do. That's the only thing. And I had taken the year before my geometry, and that year I think they were teaching the geometry again. I had changed class, you see,
mm-hmm.
and they were teaching geometry again, so I couldn't take algebra. And anyway, I wasn't getting anywhere. I couldn't see that it was getting me anywhere. My older brother, I'd heard that they were starting to pay salaries in the shanties at the Maniwaki in the bush. People were getting $45-$50 a month.
Big money?
Big money. And he wanted to go and try it. And so during the Christmas holidays, I decided to stay home. And he went to the bush. He didn't want to stay on the farm. He had been discouraged by the depression and things like that. My dad was 52 years older than I was. He was 70.
Right.
So he was an old man at that time. And I didn't have... And the choice that I had... There was a boys here, the hotel's son. He was a graduate from a commercial course in... at the University of Ottawa, couldn't find himself a job. first job he got was at the bank at Navin, I think at $35 a month. He was boarding at Mrs. Clark.
Oh, yeah, Elsie?
No, another Mrs. Clark that was in the big brick house on the left-hand side. I think it's Remy Cleroux that lives there now.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a Mrs. Clark living there. He was boarding there, I think, for $5 a week.
A lot of your salary.
Oh, Jesus, Murphy.
Were there only the two boys in your family that...
No, there were three boys. Mm-hmm. There were three boys. I had an older brother, too.
And neither one really...
Neither one wanted to.
Do you think it was because of the depression for both of them?
I would think so. You know, under depression, you couldn't get nowhere. My dad had the farm, so I had the choice of the farm or going to school and maybe not get a job. So I decided to stay with the farm. And my dad was old, and I knew he loved. He had built he had a good house, he had a good stable, he had a good herd, he had a good farm. And I knew he was attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And had I not stayed, either I had to sell or do something, eh? And this is the last thing he wanted to do. So I decided to take over, and I was 18. I just turned 18.
Do you think it was partly due to the fact you were kind of discouraged at school? Do you think you would have gone on to...
Yeah, my intention, I'd like to go to agricultural school. And I didn't have the right. I didn't have my Latin. I didn't. At that time, you had to have Latin to go. And I had lots of subjects that I didn't have, and I couldn't see how I could get there. And so I said, I don't think I chose farming. I think I was trapped into it. When I found out that I was trapped into it, I thought I was going to be. I'd make every effort possible to be the best farmer.
Do you think you
were? I took courses at Kempville, short courses. I remember we took a short course, my brother and I, after he was came back from the shanties, he decided to be a cheesemaker. And the course, he had got a book from Kempville there, and he was starting a cheesemaker course on the 2nd of January. And at that time, there was a short course while the other regular pupils were away during the Christmas holidays.
Mm-hmm. What year would this be?
Maybe 40. 39, 40. Well, yeah, 40. About 40. I know it was Mr. McPhail that was the principal there at that time, anyway, and that's a long time ago. And there was a short course there for young farmers. And I remember we got there, most of the English pupils, they had got there on the 1st of January in the evening, you know, and we, the French people, we generally celebrate New Year's Day. So we got there in the forenoon on the 2nd of January, but they had come out of it, and they knew we were working. Sorry, the first lesson that I got when I reached the gang, they were giving a... How do you say? Not a lesson, a talk.
A lecture.
On sheep. And there was four sheep there, you know. I think there was eight. Four of two different
breeds.
So I was listening. They give us a card after the lecture, and you got to judge them, you know. Well, I glasses held. I went and I just marked them. You know, I didn't know nothing. I'd never been close to a sheep before. He picks up all these cards, and he had these cards in his spare room. I guess he seen this name, Desang. Murphy, who's that guy? We'll call him up. My first name that comes up. My name. I says, what the hell do I do with that? I have no nothing. So I got up and I says, I wish you'd excuse me. I said, I came in late. I know absolutely nothing about sheep. I never was so close to a sheep. So they all smiled, and he excused me, and he said, okay. He named somebody else, but why my name came up, you know.
Luck of the draw, probably.
Yeah, well, you know, just like a draw, you know. And anyway, I says, hell, you know, my name I'll never came up, and I remember that this was my first experience at Kempville, I guess. And I guess this gave me a liking to try to. So I got into every agricultural magazine that I could find.
Do you think it made you a better farmer in hard times? Like the 40s were a little bit better than the 30s.
Yes,
but
after
the war, of course, things, the 50s were fairly good too. But a lot of farmers that I've talked to were uneducated, or didn't have an opportunity to get any schooling, nor did they after. Do you think it helped you?
Oh, I think it did a lot. Oh, yeah, and my personality, that's what I'm sure. It got me involved.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was the only farmer around here that had nearly a 12th year,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, they had a farmer's club, you know, that had been organized, that was organized here. I remember going to the club, and, you know, I'd read agricultural magazines, and I'd come up with something, and I remember the old people, first time I read about selective herbicides,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you could spray oats, kill some weeds and not kill the goats, you know. My involvement with all the agricultural world, I don't know if it's because of my personality or because I wanted to learn. That's it. It's because I wanted to learn. It was in me to try and...
It was a desire.
It was a desire in me to learn all I could about farming and try to apply it to the best of my knowledge. I remember, I think I was the first one around here to use fertilizer, possibly the first one around here to use lime. I remember the first truck of lime I got. We weren't equipped to spread it. We spread it with the manure spreader, you know, and it was quite a task. And I remember neighbors telling, oh, he's got lots of money, spreading it in the field. But the next year, it worked wonders.
Mm-hmm.
It worked wonders. Our land here.
When would this be?
Early 40s. Well, in the 40s. Do you know where the lime came from? I'm going to tell you.
No.
You know the Highlands? Celerable Boulevard?
Yes.
Yeah? There's three big towers. There used to be two. They built one again a year or two ago there. Where the two towers are, that there was a quarry. It was Kirby's quarry. That my first stroke of limestone came from that quarry. At that time, Vanier well, it was called Eastview at that time. It didn't come near. At the Celera Boulevard, that was another village there that was called Forbes.
Oh, I've never heard that.
Yeah. Maple Leaf Hotel there.
Oh, yeah.
There was a, they call that Forbes. There was a post office there, Forbes. And anyway, that's where my first, that was in the 40s. That was in the 40s. I remember that was the first load of limestone that was spread on. And I remember I had spread it on 3 acres. We got 6 tons, I think, at that time. That was a big drop. And put that on 3 acres. And the next year, we seeded that down. And I remember on that 3 acres, I got twice as much hay as I got on the other field, which was 7 acres beside it, you know.
Wow.
You know. So, I remember my dad. My dad was a progressive man, too. He didn't have any grudge if I tried anything new, you know. A fellow that bought a tractor like this and a thrashing machine in 1924, you know.
Yes, is progressive. That's earlier than most.
And, he did. They did a lot of thrashing for all the people around.
Did in the 30s, a lot of farms around the area had a lot of trouble keeping going, and there were farms taken by the bank and this kind of thing. But your farm seems to have survived without.
Yes,
it had its troubles.
Okay,
obviously,
I'm going to tell you a story about how we nearly went bankrupt. I suppose that must have been, my dad, I lost my mother in 1926, my dad remarried in 1928, that was in the early 30s. In the early 30s, my dad and a lot of other progressive farmers from here to Ottawa invested in a dairy that they called the Rideau Dairy. They all invested $1,000. We weren't getting much money for our milk during the Depression. And the fellow that initiated that was a garage man from Rockland, a fellow by the name of Jim Shane. And he was a businessman, I guess, in whom most of the people had confidence. And I remember him coming to talk my dad into this, and they'd all invest $1,000 into this dairy. And I guess he got about 30 of them, I guess, 25 maybe, $25,000. And maybe he needed 50 to start, you know. But he started with less money than he should, and it didn't work. Anyway, they operated quite a few years, and they operated right, there's a golf station, it's just on this side at Vanier, just on this side of the bridge. Montgomery Street, Montgomery, you know where Montgomery?
No, River Road's on...
Yeah, well, and then the other street this way is Montgomery, I think.
Okay.
And it was, I think there was something else on the corner, it was possibly the next. There's a big golf, I think, gas station there now. There was a garage there after the dairy went. It did go bankrupt. Albert Leduc here, he was the storekeeper, mm-hmm. And he was quite a wealthy man. And instead of letting the thing go down and letting the people all lose the money, he took the mortgage and operated under the name of Leduc et Frère for quite a few years. But I remember during the Depression, my dad shipping the milk for 4 months and not getting one penny for the milk. He nearly went crazy, not getting one penny.
Mm-hmm.
And then worse than that, they had to, with the first share, they gave them 3 common shares of $100. They had to reinvest that $300, which was a lot of money at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They had to reinvest
that. So no cash.
And I remember he was late in his payments, but he didn't have a big mortgage. He had a couple of $1,000, $2,000 or $3,000 mortgage. And I remember he was late in his payments, and that was worried him. And there's no money coming in. You have to live.
But it wasn't a bank mortgage. It was through...
No, a private person at Hammond. A fellow by the name of Mr. Corrier. I remember driving down there in the buggy with him every time. I took that mortgage over when I bought the farm. I think it was $2,500. If I remember, maybe at that time it was maybe $3,000, $3,000, $4,000. I don't remember what it was, but I remember my dad, that worried him very much. And they lost all their money that they had invested in it, and they lost months of milk. One time they lost 4 months of milk, the other time they lost 2 months of milk.
That's a lot of milk, a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. But on a dairy farm, it's your only income, eh? So I remember them during the Depression, they're selling cows for $10, I remember when pork got down to 10 cents, my dad sold all of his pigs. And on before Christmas, he bought a dressed pork from a neighbor, the Does.
Mm-hmm.
He bought a dressed pork, 150 pounds, $5, 5 cents a pound. $7.50 for a dressed pork that they brought, and they laid them on the table, 150 pounds of pork, $7.50 my dad gave him. Pork, 5 cents a pound.
That's crazy. Did you, aside from the pigs until they went down, did the farm have any other supplemental income? Or?
No. A few eggs, 50 hens or something like that, We had a hen house that could house about 50 hens. That's all we had. We had strictly a dairy farm, and I remember keeping a few pigs, but not to a very big extent.
Yeah.
My dad was a dairy farmer. He,
mm-hmm.
he always bought purebred bulls, mostly from George McCullough.
Mm-hmm.
Ever hear of George McCullough?
No, I don't think so.
He, where Sam Ratbull?
Yes.
Farm? Right across where the Robinsons are. There.
All right.
That was George McCullough. He was a prominent Holstein breeder and an auctioneer. He was a prominent. Epworth Farms, they call it.
Yeah, there's some, you've always been Holsteins then?
Yes. As far as I remember, it was always a Holstein. I went into purebred the Holsteins a few years after I took over the farm. It was George McCullough, I think, that was my godfather into this. And my dad had always been very friendly with the McCulloughs, and he bought most of his... You always bought purebred
mm-hmm.
Sires from George McCullough. He was a prominent Holstein breeder. He had very, very many, but he had very good ones.
Well, that was important then.
Yeah.
I had heard, I don't know whether they were around here, that in the 30s and 40s, a lot of Americans used to come up and buy cattle.
Oh, yeah, that was later. Yeah, I think it must have been more in the 40s, 50s maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Somebody has mentioned that there was a lot of Americans coming out looking for cattle.
That's right. We sold cattle to Americans. But they didn't come during the Depression.
I guess they couldn't afford it either.
Possibly not.
Before Rideau Dairy and Le Duc et Frère, I imagine you sold your milk to the cheese factory?
Yeah.
Was it this one?
Because my dad was a progressive man. The cheese factory is operated from, April to November or December, the very latest, eh? And at the last of the season, the price of the milk went up when the cows were going down, eh? So my dad got his heifers to come in the fall. One year, I suppose, maybe his heifers were, I don't know if it was accidental or if he had planned that, I don't remember. But his heifers, he had about 8 heifers that came in the fall. So in the fall, he had lots of milk. And the cheese factory closes. What do you do with the milk? He bought himself a new cream separator, had a lot of milk to separate, shipped the cream. At the same time, Montreal was short of milk. So some fellows came to the, it was Fred Cagey here was the station agent, and some fellows came around from Montreal who didn't have enough of milk in the province of Quebec to supply the city. The city was booming, growing like a mushroom at that time. So in 1928, we started to ship milk to Montreal.
Whole milk or just...
Whole milk. Take it to the Leonard station. When we started, maybe 3 cans a day. And then I remember shipping 8-10 cans of milk, you know, in the summertime. And they gave us quotas at that time. The amount of milk that you sent, like in the 4 winter months, November, December, January, and February, was the amount of milk that you got paid at high price in the summertime. Okay? The other, you were paid surplus price, which was sometimes lower than the cheese factory. So I remember taking our surplus to the cheese factory, which mm-hmm. was where Bourbonnais are now,
mm-hmm.
and I remember shipping some milk to Montreal. But I remember my dad shipping quite a bit of milk and getting checks of $500, which was something out of this world at that time, you know, for a farm. Was something out of this world. Something out of this world. This was before the Depression. Just for, well, maybe 1928-29, just when the Depression happened. Well, Montreal had enough of milk or something like that. We were going to be cut off or something like that. And this is about the time that these fellows tucked them into...
Rideau Dairy.
To the Rideau Dairy. And they quit shipping milk to Montreal, which was very low price. There was the Depression, you see. And cheese, 50 cents. I think they... At the cheese factory, I think they got something like 50, 60
How much did
cents
you
a hundred for milk.
Yeah. Well, you had to kind of pay the cheese factory for
yeah.
processing, right?
Yeah. And I think what they got left was something like 50 cents a 100 pounds or something like that. You know, something
not
awful.
High.
Ridiculously low. Ridiculously low, you know. And, you know, this all these things were an incentive. You know, somebody tuck you in if you deliver your milk and distribute it and then ding, 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 you know, that you could make more money out of it. And this is how they got involved. Fred Rivet-Bal's father was involved in this thing too. Rancourt's at Gratton's, Henri's, most of them were Perrault's.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Perrault there, and I don't remember them all. Proulx, Napoleon Proulx, where Gerard Proulx, where they have the sugar bush there.
Yeah.
They're his father. He was involved in that. They took all the progressive
farmers. They knew which ones
and,
you were.
That could invest $1,000 into this.
In the 30s, when things, before things got, I guess, bad, did you buy much machinery in those days, or
no.
just live with what you had?
Oh, no, you just live with what you had. No, what the machinery at that time. Since I can remember, we always used that tractor to put in the crop.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time we used it on the, in the field. And we had a double disc to put behind that, and that's the only machinery we had to put behind the tractor. We never had a plow. We always plowed with the horses.
How many teams did you keep?
We always had two teams of horses. Yeah. And we always plowed with the horses. And mostly with a double furrow plow. He thought that the... well, my dad never bought. I remember my brother, Victor, he used to sell the farm machinery. And he did some plowing with the tractor. And, it was, most of our plowing was done with the horses.
Yeah.
The only time we used the tractor was to put in the crop in the spring. And
year
during Depression, my dad said, we can't afford gas this year. And we started to work with the horses, and we got some warm days. We weren't getting nowhere. You know, you could do so much in one day with the tractor, you know, and horses are horses, they're animals, and you get a warm day, you know, and
they can
only do so much, eh? So, every year we use the tractor to put in the crop. That's the only time. After that, you'd put the tractor in the shed until the fall when the trashing time come, the trashing machine.
Did you ever have to work off the farm in those days at all during the winter?
I never did.
Probably took all of you to stay on, if you were the only one.
I always had hired men. I never worked up. Never did.
Yeah, you're probably fortunate to have enough cows.
Yeah, I always had a hired man, and my dad always had a hired man. I never worked out a day in my life.
I'm moving up to the 40s here. When the war came, did you ever worry you'd have to go?
No, I was the only one on the farm. Never worried I had to go. I remember going for, and after, when I was 21, my health wasn't that good either. I was 21. I was operated for appendicitis. When I got my notice to go, I was in the hospital. It was in March of 39, exactly. In 40. It started in 39, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In March of 40. I had been laid up in Valley Acre or something. This was Holy Thursday, and the Easter was just as early as this year. Easter was
March.
In March. And my dad told me, he says, if I was you, I'd go and see doctor. Our doctor at that time was
Kennedy.
Our specialist. We had Dr. Irwin in Navin, but my dad's doctor was the Dr. Pera in Hull. Dr. Pera in Hull had relatives around here, and most of the people knew him, and I think he was one of the first doctors that had an x-ray in the city of Ottawa in Hull. He had went to France to study x-ray. And he came back and he bought himself an x-ray, and he had an x-ray in his office. And he used it for a lot of things that they shouldn't have. Well, at that time, they were doing a lot of things. They were treating eczema with x-ray, and he burned me. Oh, yeah. And a lot of doctors, you know, you don't feel nothing.
No.
There was a doctor in Maniwaki that burnt all his fingers off. You know, today you know the way, eh? They stick you in a room here, and they put a
lead shield
in front of you, and they get out to go and push the button, eh? And at that time, the doctor stayed right there, and he pushed the button, or he had a little timer there for 20 seconds when he gave you a treatment or something like that. But he worked miracles. I seen a lady that went there, her hands were full of eczema. He put her hands there, put the x-ray, measured it, didn't it? Turned the button, 20 seconds or something like that. A few days after, her x-ray was gone. Her eczema was gone, you know?
Amazing.
But if you put maybe 3 seconds more, maybe the skin had come off too, you know?
Yeah.
But it just did enough to burn the right cells or something like that. Anyway, my dad, and I tell you how I went up to Ottawa. I wanted to wait after Easter. to go see the doctor. And this was only Thursday. And then when I got up in the morning and I said, hell, if anything happened during the Easter holidays, I says, he'd blame me forever. And I felt this pain in my stomach, you know, just as if I was wearing corset or something, you know. Not a pain, but a bad feeling, you know. So, milk truck. Going to town every day, so I hopped on with the milk truck. When I got to McCullough's, he stopped there for a few cans of milk, and Mrs. McCullough and her sister-in-law were on there to get onto the truck with Mr. Ridger. So I went into the back, sat on the day. And this was in March and cold, you know, like this year, you know. Sat on the cans at the back and you roll it up of your collar, and he stopped different places for milk on the way up, and I finally got to the dairy, and I had a friend, and he still lives there as far as that goes, on Augusta Street. So I worked I walked from the Redo Dairy across the bridge to Augusta, and when I got there I had an appointment with the doctor for 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Or 4 o'clock, I think. Just 4 o'clock. So I had lots of time, you see. When I got there, he was taking a walk, going to the store or something, so I went up there with him. I came back and I had dinner there. And 4 o'clock, I managed to be at the doctor's office in a way, and it was possibly 4:30 or nearly 5 when he took me. Quite a few people in the office when I got in there. When he examined me, he says, you have to be operated for appendicitis today. Today. Today, no. Oh, he says, yes, today. Tomorrow, that's going to be bursted. He says, you got to operate you right off this evening. So I called my place. I don't think we had the telephone. It was only my one telephone, I guess, a few telephones in the at the store and the hotel. And there was only a few. I think I called to Legix and told him that to tell my dad I was going to be operated at 7 o'clock. And I was operated that evening for appendicitis, and I had one whale of a time. I had one whale. At that time they kept you in bed for about 8 or 9 days. Did the doctor come in? Did you have cramps today? No. I was starting to eat soup and things, you know. Next day come in, did you have cramps today? No. Getting up in bed in England, and I started to have cramps. And I did have. He gave me castor oil. And I think I was out of the hospital for a week. And my bowels were still moving about 4 times a day, I think. Maybe 5. Anyway, when I got out of the hospital, they treated me with sulfur. There was no penicillin at that time. Treated me with sulfur. The damn sulfur didn't react good with me. I had that kind of eczema all over my body. Mm-hmm. And then after a few days it all went away, but it settled in the hairy places, in the face and down. So you go to see the doctor, and finally I went to see Dr. Pera. He treated me with x-ray. In the spring, it all went away. And the fall, came back, go to see Dr. Perry again. Gave me a couple of three treatments. It was no fun.
And that was the last time you had a treatment?
Yeah, that was the last time I had a treatment. And I guess, do you remember? You don't remember these things. When my kids were young, we used to go in stores. They had x-rays. You don't remember that? You'd buy a pair of shoes and you stick your shoes in and you could see your toes and things. It didn't cost you anything. The thing was there for you to use, just like a penny weight scale there, you know?
Scales.
Like a penny scale there, you know? And the first damn thing they knew everybody was having, at first they thought it was, what do you call this, foot disease?
Like of the mouth.
You know, the skin comes off.
Athlete's foot.
Everybody thought it was athlete's foot in the first time. You know, they found out that these it came from these X-ray machines. Every department store, Freeman's and La Roque's. I remember my kids were small. Hell, we used to go in and buy, even if we didn't buy a pair of shoes, we used to stick our foot and look at your toes, see how you're...
I didn't grow up near a city, so maybe that's why. I'm not from anywhere near a city when I grew up.
Oh,
that's
Jesus,
probably why.
Murphy, you know. So, you know, all of these things were there. People didn't know. Didn't know about it. People didn't know about it. They found out about X-ray years ago, I guess in Europe, and when it came to this country, it was working marvels for a lot of things. And anyway, this gave me trouble for a long time. So, health-wise, I wasn't fit. And another time, I had the farm to operate. I was the only one on the farm. So, I knew a lot of my cousin that was... in the Dieppe War, that was a poor guy. He came back half crippled, and then married, and then didn't have a very happy life, and started to drink, and he drank. Died a couple of years ago there in his 60s.
War changed everybody, including probably people here.
Yeah.
But a lot of the farmers around here, I think, were exempted.
Oh yes. If you had a farm, you were exempted, or if you were the only son of the farm, or something like that.
Yeah, they had enough. Talking about the X-ray, that brings me to a question. You were quite progressive in the 40s, introducing a lot of new things to the farm. One of the things, obviously, is herbicides and chemicals for your fields.
Yes.
There's a lot of controversy now about that.
Yes.
And I'm
very much aware.
Did you think then that in 40 years it would be such a controversy?
No. Not even 10 years ago. Not even 5 years ago. We're just beginning to find out about the controversies. From this year on, anybody that does any spraying, they have to...
You mean just for atrazine and stuff?
Yes, everything. You won't be able to buy it if you don't have your license. You won't be able to buy it. But I suppose there'll be some with a license that'll buy it and maybe give it to their neighbors, you know, or something like that didn't take the course. But I know a lot of them that took the course there a couple of weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago. And most of them that still do spraying, they were there. They're damn well aware now of the damage.
In the 40s, though, when herbicides and chemicals were just coming on the market, was there any warnings, or did they just say they were miracle workers?
Absolutely not. And they were so weak at that time compared to what we have today. Fertilizers, you know. I remember, I think, 2,612 or something like that, you know. Nobody remembers that. Except me, I guess.
Maybe you were the only one that used them.
They were jute bags, and there was like a paper bag inside the jute bag, because it was, and they were 100-pound bags. And a few years later, it all changed to 50-pound bags. But I remember those damn bags. They were heavy, and we put on so little. And it made so much difference, you know, because our land here is low in phosphate, you know. And so what we use was super phosphate. I remember using super, we'd buy a ton of super phosphate in the fall and spread it in the stable, you see, and it gave a good smell in the stable. It went through in with the gutter, and it made our manure a little better. Mm-hmm. And we'd buy maybe a ton or ton and a half or 2 tons at the most, you know, at that time, you know. Today you buy 20 tons.
Overindulge, I think.
And I'm so much aware that being a retired farmer today, I took a course on these, how do you call them? You have a farmer's association that just use no fertilizers there.
Yeah, organic.
Organic farmer's association. And I took a course there last fall. And I gave a talk at the crop improvement. I told them all I knew them about, made them very much aware. Made them very much aware of the damage that we could do to the environment. And I'm one of the first ones that introduced these things. And not sorry, but it's like everything else. I think we're overindulging in it.
Using too much?
Using too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Europe certainly has a problem.
Yeah.
And Canada will
if they don't.
I want you to kind of go back and take me through a typical day in the 30s. I know there wasn't any typical days, but through milking and what time you got up and what you would do during the day.
Yeah.
Let's say
mid-April,
that's planting time.
Mid-April at planting time. Or I could give you one in February, when we used to haul ice from the Ottawa River.
As well as do chores.
In the winter time, well, I'm going to start in the winter time.
Okay.
In the winter time, the first thing we did after the snow came, we'd buy some bush, some wood someplace. Here at the Larmer's, or there was bush farms 4 or 5 miles away from here, and we had to have some wood to keep the house warm. So we used to buy about 10 loads of wood. We'd bring that to the yard, and then there was lots of time to. So after it got cold, and the next thing, we were shipping whole milk, so we had to have ice to cool the darn thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you take your milk to the cheese factory where you could cool it with well water or something like that, if you had a good well, or some of them had a dug well and they'd put the big can down in the well or something like that, you know. But if you were shipping milk, you had to have a little bit better milk, so you had to have some way of cooling it. And at that time, we didn't have no electricity, no refrigeration, so we had to have an ice house. So we used to bring in about 400 or 500 blocks of ice from the river.
How often? Like, is that a year? Or?
Yes. And then draw sawdust from all the little sawmills that there was around. I remembered going for a load of sawdust at Buckingham.
With your horse?
With your horse, oh yes.
Oh yeah,
quite a trip, and quite an experience. I was afraid, and across the river. Yeah.
What time
it
of year?
It had got mild. It was possibly early April, and it had snowed. Had a good snowstorm. So I says it's a good day. But then the warm weather comes, the sun comes up, and when I loaded at the other end of Buckingham, there was a sawmill there, and I loaded my load of sawdust and had a great big load, and there was no way I could come down the road to Masson. So they made me take across the Lever River and came on another crossroad on the other side, and another secondary road on the other side of the river. But then when I got to Masson, I had to cross the river again, and on the bridge there was no snow at all.
Hmm.
And that wasn't with sleighs, eh? When I got so far, I stuck. But there was always somebody at that time to
help you out.
The fella came with a truck. You seen him that? He put his truck behind my sleigh and he pushed me across the bridge. And there was snow. And I got along and got onto the river. And I was standing on my load. And every once in a while you could hear it crack like that, you know. It was a winter road, you know. I guess it wasn't dangerous. Possibly the ice was, but I'm not.
Makes you nervous.
I'm not used to that to that stuff, you know, and I was damn nervous. I was standing on top of the load and everything went down. I was going to jump.
You were ready.
I was ready. I was ready to jump, but got across anyway. And on this side, the road was all right. But this was what we had to do in the wintertime. First, wood for our stove wood, and then the ice. And then in April, we never got up before any 6 o'clock or something like that. We never got up at 4 o'clock or anything like that. We weren't. We'd get up at 6 o'clock, and the first thing you know, you go down to the stable to milk the cows.
It's hand milking back then.
Yeah, 40.
When did we get our
first milker in 42.
Earlier than most.
Yeah, we got our first milker in 42.
So yeah. When did you get electricity here?
39. Exactly, I know. My stepmother died in 39, and the house was wired. The stable wasn't wired. Got the electricity, I think, the day after she was buried. I remember we had called the hydro if they couldn't come and connect us because of this thing. And the house in 39. And in the stable the next year. Yeah. And very poor electricity. Oh, it was terrible.
Off and on?
There was one transformer at the corner. You know? When they got electricity here, there was six houses maybe that they got the electricity, the store and the hotel and the bake shop. And, you know, well, maybe 10 houses maybe that got the electricity. That was possibly 36 or 30, a couple of years, two or three years before we had it anyway. Just at that time, I guess my dad was so involved with the redo there that he just couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember we got it in 39 in a way at the house. And we brought it down to the stable in the next year. Yeah. Cotton at Navin that wired mm-hmm. the stable, Ed Cotton,
mm-hmm.
and in 42, yeah, it was in 42, my brother was selling milking machines. He was selling machinery for Massey Harris, they called it at that time, and they were selling, and I remember that, it was in 1942 we bought the first milking machine.
But before that, in 1940, it was by hand.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Were you fast?
Pardon?
Were you fast, milker?
Oh, the most cows I milked at any time was 17, I guess. But we always had help most of the time. It's when we were stuck sometimes. Some of them didn't show up, or some people were sick, or something like that. But... like, if we were milking 20 cows, we were always about three to milk, you know. My dad milked cows until he was 75. Hey, 72. In 42, he was born in 66. So, in 1900, he'd be 34. And then 42... Yeah, that'd be 76. Well, he'd have been 75 and 76 in October, and we bought this thing in the spring. So, I remember, he milked cows until he was 75. In the last years, that was about the only things he'd do. I think he fed the hens and a few little things like that, you know.
Probably deserved a rest.
Yeah, he did, for sure. Sure.
Did either of your mother or your stepmother work in the barn, or...?
No. Women never worked on the farm in our place.
Had enough to do in the house?
Yes.
Not hens or chickens or?
No. Women were in the house at my place. I don't remember.
Tradition.
Yeah, I don't.
More than and if there's enough men on the farm, they usually don't.
Yeah. No. No, women never, I remember my wife came to help me on extraordinary times when I had a backache or something and the hired man didn't show up one morning or something like that, and wouldn't you come and help? I don't remember. Well, when my mother died, I was only 6 years old. But when my father remarried, I was 8 years old. And I don't remember.
Well, they worked hard enough in the house, you
were
saying?
Yes, 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 yes.
With meals and...
Yes, and, yes, and with the equipment that they had at that time. But, they didn't know any better, and they were satisfied with what they were doing. They always had ice, as far as I can remember, you know, like since 1928. We always had ice. We had an ice box, you know. Not very many people had that.
No, that's very fortunate.
You know, I remember every night, you know, we'd put a great big piece of ice in the tank, and we'd cut another little, chop off another little chunk to bring to the ice house nearly every day or every second day or whatever, and we had a place to keep the milk and things, you know. And
yeah. Okay, back to your day here in the winter. You're up at about 6 and you're down in the barn milking.
Yeah.
So how long would milking take you?
Well, an hour, I guess.
That's pretty fast for hand milking.
Yeah.
About
three? No. We'd never milk for any more than an hour.
Now, how many cows were you milking?
Oh, 7 or 8. You know, like if we had 20 cows, we'd be three milkers. We'd be three milkers. And then everything had to be in the hand, cleaning the stable and everything. We'd chore all forenoon. Take the manure to the field.
Mm-hmm. You spread all year?
No. Just put it in a pile in the field. Dump it in a sleigh. Take it to the field. And then in the wintertime, we had to clip the cows and keep the cows clean. And we always had work. We have possibly had a little spare time, like after dinner.
Yeah, what did you...
In the wintertime.
Did you have any social times in the community and that...
Very little. Very, very, very little parties and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, this is like the 30s and 40s again with the church. I don't know, the church is a big part of the community.
Yes. And besides that, there was nothing. Besides that, there was nothing. I remember, 40s maybe. Yeah. There was a young school teacher at Leonard, a fellow by the name of Little. He had organized a little club, and we played in the old town hall, with the bird there.
Oh, badminton.
Badminton. Yes. We played badminton. There was a couple of fellows from young Klima here, he was the mail boy, so he used to go and get the mail at Leonard, so he got involved with Aidan Coburn. You didn't?
Oh yeah, I knew of Aidan, I never met him.
You never met him, eh?
No.
I used to play with Aidan Coburn and Francis Coburn.
Oh really?
Yeah. And this
young
guy,
still a
couple of others, guys from Leonard there, we played badminton there. Maybe a winter or two. But there was no place. No school had a gymnasium. None. Very few halls.
No Saturday night dances?
No Saturday night dances, no. Later on, the first dance hall that I remember that started around here was the Meadowlands. And, oh hell, that was after we were married. We were married in 43.
Is your wife from around
yes,
here?
Yes, she's from Frenchville.
What's her maiden
name? La France. The big brick house just on this side of Frenchville there.
You must be related to half the township then.
No, I'm not. Dessins, there's no hardly any others. We're the only ones.
No, but there's Dessin, LaFrance, and now Smiths, and by the time you round up all your relatives, I'm sure there's quite a pile.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite a pile because we've got a big family.
Yes.
There's 10 of them there.
Oh, that is a big family.
And, we haven't got that many relatives. We haven't got that many relatives around here. But, when they started this dance hall at Cumberland at the Meadowlands, you know where that thing is there now? I think there's maybe a few apartments in there now. Hell, that was quite a thing. That used to be a good going affair. And they had dances there, I think, a couple of times a week at one time there. Otherwise,
well, if you were married in 43, then
yes.
Probably socializing, you didn't much after you started having a family and kids. And,
except and with the close friends, with the family.
Was I assume in most cases in small communities, the church was very important in
the
social life and politics and everything else back then?
Politics? Oh, hot politics. Like what?
You just read more probably in Quebec than here, but the...
Oh, yes. Oh, different in Quebec. Oh, my God. I have Duplessis's book there. He influenced the clergy, you know, like...
Was it the same
even
here?
Influenced the Pope, I think.
Wasn't it here?
Father, there was a Father Charbonneau. Charbonneau in Montreal, you know, that spoke against Duplessis's regime, and they had had a Dogville. He sided with the the people that made I don't have the English word for it there. It's a strike, you know. He sided with the strikers, and he came out against the government, you know. And the first darn thing you knew, you know, he sent one of his ministers to Rome or something, you know, and Father Charbonneau was transferred to Victoria, you know.
Oh, those things happen quite frequently.
Transferred to Victoria and died there. No, and a lot of people wrote about him, you know, and
it wasn't the same you find in Ontario?
I don't think so. We never had influence like that from the clergy in Ontario. That maybe there was some priest someplace that did, you know, but not like what you hear in Quebec.
Well, it was pretty corrupt with the Duplessis regime.
Well, hell, you know, when a priest would get up in the pulpit and say, well, vote, it's your duty to vote. Vote for whoever you want. But you know who put the pavement in the...
on the road.
or in the churchyard, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there was.
Or something like this, you know. Oh, Jesus. No, I...
No influence like that.
I can't recall of any influence like that or any talk, you know, against the clergy or for the clergy because of political issues, you know. I don't remember. So, we had a priest here that was very, very agricultural and very religious, and his name was Father Laflamme, you know.
Mm-hmm. When would this be enough?
Oh, he was here between 1911 and he was here until the 50s, you know. He was here for 43 years. And he had a large influence, I think, on people my age and a lot of other people. To him, as far as he was concerned, to save your soul, you had to be a farmer.
An interesting philosophy.
And you had to be close to nature. Or be a priest. And I think we had three boys from this parish that were agriculturists, you know, that went to agricultural school, you know. And I don't think it was his influence that got me onto the farm. It was incidental or accidental, whatever you call it. My dad was in his 70s and I was in my 20s. And the farm was there and there was no other job.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Had jobs been available, I'd have possibly went out to work. And there was no job available. So that's why I say I don't think I was... Because when I was 15 and going to school like at Rockland, I don't think then I intended to be a farmer at all. But when I went to school at Navan, I guess I was closer to agriculture. I helped a little bit on the farm. I used the horse to drive to Navan. In the summer I worked on the farm. And then I started to work on the farm with other boys that were working at my place. And at that time, I guess my dad was starting to make a little money. And then he could pay us some small wages. And it's about 17, 18 years old that I got a liking to it. And I said, if I'm going to make my living here, I just will learn all I can about the darn thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I had a desire to learn about farming, because I could see a lot of others that were always doing the same things, always the same way all the rest of their life, you know? And I thought maybe they would.
Did the community produce any priests during the same time?
Yes. Three, I think.
Three agriculturalists and
three priests.
He probably figured he did his job well then.
Possibly, yeah. Two of them are dead now. The two brothers, farmer brothers, and Rangerie. I don't know. I found another one, Joubertville. Four, I guess. Yeah, he's still a priest at the Montfort Parish. And Rangerie is at the General Hospital, and the other two are dead. They died. One of them is my age. He's died quite a few years ago. And the other fellow was a missionary in Africa, 27 years, Uganda.
Tough place.
So when he came back, he only lived a few years.
Mm-hmm. One of the, because it's a French community, maybe it's just my prejudice that thinks a lot of Quebec culture would be here too.
Yeah.
But in days when you had a family, usually you had to have one for the church as well as one for the land.
I think my mother, when I was young, first of all, I wasn't supposed to ever be born, you see. My older brother was 6 years old, 6.5 years old when I was born. He had two daughters and two sons, you see, and they all had them pretty far apart. And the youngest daughter was an invalid. She was a retarded girl, and the other one was a very bright girl. And the very bright girl, they sent her to the convent at Vanier there, you know,
mm-hmm.
right beside Belleuse there.
Mm-hmm.
Les filles de sagesse, the ladies of wisdom there. I think they're the ones that used to operate Montfort Hospital there. And before these things were, and I think there's some of them still working there. Anyway, they sent her to that school, and she died at 14 years old with in March before I was born, and that's the time that my mother got pregnant for me. That was an awful blow to my parents, you know. When she died, she, peritonitis, which appendicitis stuff burst, you know.
You can't do anything in those days.
Yeah, in those days, you know. You know, she had a some kind of a big belly ache, and I suppose that they didn't know if it was her menstruation or what it was, and I don't know if they put hot water or cold or whatever they did. They did something that was wrong. The thing bursted. And my dad used to, in the 20s, he used to take hay or some of his produce to Ottawa, to the market, and he stopped in to see her, and he seen she was sick and pale. And the next day he took the train. That time when we used to go to Ottawa, we'd drive to Leonard with the horse, tie the horse in the Protestant church shed there, Baptist church shed, and take the train. Ottawa, 11 o'clock, come back on the 5 o'clock train. I did that many times. And the next day, he went to town, and he took her to the doctor. And the doctor gave her a tonic, I suppose, right? A bottle of medicine.
Yeah, that's
come
normal.
Home. She was vomiting. Took her back to the doctor. The doctor took her to the hospital, and they operated, and she died. This happened to my mother, 1926. She had a tumor after I was born. She always felt a lump in her stomach. The lump got bigger and bigger and bigger. At the time she went to operate, she was just like a 7-month pregnant or something like that. She was 44 years old. They operated.
Yeah.
She died.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly didn't have medicine.
It was terrible at that time.
Yeah.
Anybody that went, a neighbor down here, went for a rupture. Well, you know, at that time, half of the men were ruptured. You know, they used to force, like, you know, and they were so darn proud, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody could lift the front wheel of a tractor, I remember people trying to lift the front wheel of the tractor here, and my brother, my big brother, he could lift that. I couldn't. I never tried either. But people were proud, you know. If you could do it,
they wanted to do it.
Half of the men were, more than that. I think 75% of the men were ruptured. And I remember this man was ruptured anyway, and they used to wear belts for their rupture. And sometimes the belt didn't stay when they were working the right place, and then this rupture came out. Oh my. The doctor used to come and rub it and got back in. This time he couldn't operate on him.
Died.
A rupture.
Yeah.
You know, something that's
probably
nearly out of your body.
Yeah, usually infection sets in.
And what did they have? They didn't even have aspirin, I guess. You know, they didn't have sulfa, they didn't have penicillin, they didn't. Infection set in, and that was the end.
I'm going to have to ask you what time it is.
It's 3:15.
Oop. I'm going.